Hello and welcome to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. My name is Natalie Himmelrich.
How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is completely self-funded, produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. Consider making a small donation to support the podcast. Go to bit.ly/support, capital G, capital T, and podcast. I repeat, bit.ly/supportgtpodcast. Thank you so much. And for more information, please visit Natalie's website, join the podcast Instagram page, and subscribe to the newsletter to receive updates on future episodes. So I have been personally impressed by Dr. Frank Anderson's work for quite some time due to our shared interest in trauma. And I've seen him speak with many other specialists such as David Kessler or Matthias Barker, and I feel I already know him, or at least from those details that he shared openly. So I'm very excited to bring you this week's episode and the conversation I have been personally looking forward to for months. I hope you enjoy today's episode as much as I do. About this week's guest, Dr. Frank Anderson is a Harvard-educated psychiatrist, trauma specialist, and author of the upcoming memoir, To Be Loved, A Story of Truth, Trauma, and Transformation. He is the go-to trauma expert and knows firsthand what it's like to endure the pain. Dr. Anderson has spent the past 3 decades studying neuroscience and trauma treatment, working to heal trauma and bring more love, compassion, and unity to the world. So welcome, Frank. It is so nice to have you here, for you to spend time with us on the podcast. How are you today?
Well, thank you so much. First, thank you so much for having me. You know, this is the topic that's near and dear to my heart for all kinds of reasons, which we'll talk about together on this episode. How am I doing today? It's a great question as I kind of take a moment and pause. I'm in this flurry of activity right now, which is so exciting because so many wonderful things are happening for me in spreading my message in this simultaneous landscape of so many horrific, traumatic things happening in the world, right? So what I feel is excitement in conflict with the pain of what everybody's experiencing. So I have this interesting kind of combination of, wow, this is incredible how I'm able to reach so many people in so many ways, and I'm so happy about that. I also hold a lot of pain around how we're going through so much on so many levels right now. So it's a contrast, it's a paradox. That's what I would say that I'm feeling right now in this moment.
So as I do with all of my guests, I ask them the question, so how has life touched you in terms of the experiences in the area of loss, grief, and trauma? Why don't we start there?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, as I was preparing for this podcast, I was thinking about approaching this from the flip side, interestingly enough, because oftentimes people have an acute event that is a loss that then is a traumatic event as a result of the acute loss. Say you lose a partner who has a car accident, say you lose a child who suffered from cancer, somebody that you know in your life that had a suicide or something like that. So oftentimes the loss in and of itself is traumatic. But my story is a little bit different. It's the opposite. My story is flipped, is that my trauma has created a series of losses, mm-hmm. right? It's the opposite way, because I'm somebody who doesn't really have a specific event that has perpetuated and created the experience of loss for me. it's more of an ongoing experience of growing up in childhood that then created an environment for me that made me someone who is very sensitive, attuned, and totally overwhelmed by loss. So I don't know if that makes sense, and I certainly will explain that a little bit more. I, it's interesting because I did become a trauma expert. I became a grief subspecialist, and I never really understood why. Certainly with most of my childhood and growing up, even in college and medical school, why am I so attuned to loss? Nobody died. Why am I so affected by loss? Everybody, I've never experienced that traditional loss the way everybody talks about, mm-hmm. right? So I was confused for decades about why every time do I watch a movie where somebody dies, why am I can't even contain myself. Mm-hmm. I would get so overwhelmed by it. And honestly, it didn't make sense to me for many, many years because nobody died. And it took a while for me to really understand loss at a very different level than the grief of somebody passing, which is more the more traditional loss that most people talk about, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and, for me, and it took me a while, really, like probably it's been for the last decade or so that I've really embodied what that experience of loss is for me. And it's very much related to what we call now in the field complex PTSD or relational trauma.
Yeah.
You know, surprise, surprise, my second book, Transcending Trauma, Treating IFS, Internal Family Systems for Complex Relational Trauma. You don't become an expert at something if it doesn't personally touch you. And I was like, why did I become an expert in this topic? Mm-hmm. And so it was not until I was able to connect with the parts of me that were affected by my trauma, the younger parts of me that I will say went through thousands and thousands of losses, right? It's the accumulative effect of relational violation over and over and over again that really supported me being somebody who holds enormous grief. And it took me decades to be able to process that loss. Decades, decades, decades. You know, I'm 60 years old and I've been working at this since I was 6 years old. My memoir opens. First chapter is "You're not going to school today, Frankie." And my parents sent me to psychological testing when I was 6 years old because I got caught playing with a Barbie doll in my cousin's basement. Mm-hmm. Right? And so there was this, oh my God, something's wrong with him. He's a little boy and he wants to play with a Barbie doll. Like I was a kid, I didn't know what the heck was going on. But what I did know was I am bad and wrong and I did something horrible, right? And so I was in therapy for 5 years to be somebody different than I was, right? I learned how to act like a normal boy. I watched my uncles. Like, oh, this is how you're supposed to act. This is what boys do. Play baseball, like do all this stuff. So very early on, I was forced, I'll say, strongly suggested to lose myself in order to survive. So right off the bat, I have a loss to me in order to be loved or survive in the world, right? So there's that piece. It's like disconnect from yourself, which is a huge loss because I really buried me in order to survive, right? So there's the loss of the self that I never really understood, the loss of connection to me, one layer, right? And then, you know, I grew up in a very kind of violent, verbally and physically abusive household relative to my father. So every time he flew off the handle, every time he raged through the house to attack me, I lost my father. I lost my safe parent.
Mm-hmm.
That happened hundreds and hundreds of times in my childhood. So there's this accumulative loss of a safe parent
mm-hmm.
through my father. Well, that wasn't enough for me. If you want to be an expert, you got to experience the whole range, right? And so then relative to my mom, who I was very, very close to, there was this very complicated dynamic between her being stuck right in the middle of my father and me. And she had to choose between my dad and me over and over and over again,
mm-hmm.
right? And here's the way she solved the problem, was she first promised to choose me, but then she abandoned me 100% of the time and always sided with my father because mm-hmm. she needed him for survival.
Yeah.
So then I lost a safe mother over and over and over again, right? So at a very early age, without having any awareness of any of this at all,
mm-hmm.
I have this profound loss to me. I have this ongoing loss of a safe parent in my father and this ongoing betrayal of love and safety with my mother. So I had this triple loss for decades, right? And
you explain it so beautifully. You know, like, this is why I have been looking forward to speak to you, because you put it in words for people to understand developmental trauma, right?
Yes.
And I get goosebumps when I listen to you, because you make it so palpable understanding, as where people listen to us now, they can look back and they say, ah, so loss in that case is not necessarily something that I lost, but something that I didn't have.
Well, yes, it's both, because it's both, which is super confusing, because there were moments that I really had my mother when she didn't have to choose. So I had this very tenuous loving connection that I needed for survival, but I did keep losing it. So there were moments.
Yeah.
It was there. And for me as a little kid, it was real. And my mother loves me. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was real and I had it, but it was very sporadic
mm-hmm.
and it was always taken away every time there was one of these events. And same was true with my dad. I mean, much fewer episodes, but when he wasn't drinking and when he was regulated, or if he was in a good mood or we were on vacation, I had a nice father who loved me and was connected. Do you know what I mean? I never felt love from him because the trauma outweighed the positive. It was not until much later in my life. So I could never trust even the moments that I had it with my dad because mm-hmm. they were too fleeting and too tenuous.
Too few. Mm-hmm.
But I did have that ping pong with my mom, back and forth, back and forth, back and mm-hmm. forth. With my dad, it was just safer to just shut it all out
mm-hmm.
and disconnect because it was too toxic and traumatic for me. So yeah, there were these moments of having it and then losing it with my mother. And then there was this, I never really had it with my father. And then I left myself a long time ago. You know what I mean? So it's very confusing. And again, all of that stuff was so buried deep, deep down inside of me with no awareness of it. So I'd watch a movie and there'd be a sad ending and I'd burst into tears. I'm like, what? What's your problem? Like, what the hell is this about? Like, I had no awareness because it was so buried for years and years and years. And I had that traditional view of loss. And I kept saying to
mm-hmm.
myself,
mm-hmm.
why are you crying like this? Nobody died. What's your problem? So it was more the loss of love, not the loss of a person's body.
Mm-hmm.
That was very confusing for me as a child and even as an adult, you know? And interestingly enough, I became became a trauma expert, still not knowing the root of this, because I had a very close member of our family who became psychotic when I was, when they were 12, I think, and maybe I was 16 or 17, I was older, a very close member of our family. And that was a horrible loss of them. They became psychotic, started screaming, bugs are crawling all over my face, and having poor little kid, had all this kind of psychotic episodes. And it, again, tapped into the profound loss of who he was, our neighbor, Mateo. And I felt that so profoundly. I was like, I have to save him. I have to save people like him. So I felt his pain and I felt the loss of him on a subconscious level. And that's really what drove me into becoming a doctor, becoming a psychiatrist, was resonating with the trauma and the pain of his psychosis without really knowing what it tapped into for me. But it was so palpable. I was like, I have to save him. I have to save him. So I kind of went into the, and became a doctor, became a psychiatrist to save people like him, right? Still not knowing anything about me, because again, I was 5 years weekly in therapy, learning how to suppress. Right. So went to Harvard, got into Harvard. I'm a driven person. I'm very smart, still not knowing what the heck was going on with me. Right.
Yeah.
And then started working with people who were chronically mentally ill, who really lost themselves to mental illness. And it was so overwhelming for me. I just was so overwhelmed by it. And I, you know, they always encouraged us in our residency program in psychiatry to go into therapy. But the it was always like, when you work, when you're in your second year of your training, when you work with outpatients, it will be a good idea for you to go into therapy so you can learn what it was like, right? It was like this lovely suggestion. That wasn't the case for me. I was totally freaked out, totally overwhelmed. Within the first month of my residency, I couldn't tolerate all the pain that I was sitting with my patients, but really within me. So I shot myself into therapy within the first couple months. I went 5 times a week for 11 years. Like, wow. Really, like, dove in because I was so overwhelmed, still not knowing why. And it was then, when I entered my psychiatry residency program, it's like, oh my gosh, this is about you. Oh, that was the first time in my life. I was probably 25 years old, then 27 maybe. Like, this stuff is about you, Frank. Like, this is about your history. And then I really started unpacking my trauma history and then just started learning, like, oh, these feelings are not like how empathic you are for other people, which is true. But it's like, this is about you, you know? And so that's the beginning of when I started putting the pieces together. It was like, oh my goodness. Like, yes, I'm smart. Yes, I'm kind. Yes, I'm driven. But heal thyself, right? Wounded healer is really where my journey began, around starting to put the pieces together around all that I have lost in the midst of my trauma.
Can I ask you a question? So sure. Listening to you, I was reflecting on my own family of origin, and I am a highly sensitive person. I can see that with all the things that are happening. So I'm wondering, when you're talking, do you feel that that might be part of it too, or it might be a strategy that we have learned to deal with uncertainty within the family? Do you think it is both together, or it is one over the other? Yeah, because I feel that in myself, but I know... So my family history apparently is very similar to yours.
Yes.
not alcohol, but uncertainty about trusting. Yeah. So, you know, I've been reflecting on that. It was better to be vigilant and to be empathetic, because that would resolve a lot of potential scolding or yes. anger or whatever. What would you say to that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's really complicated. I think there's many dimensions to it. I wouldn't say it's both. It's all of the above. And I'll explain that a little bit more, because there's so many layers of it. So one is for sure vigilance around an abusive parent or person's feelings, actions, and behaviors is very important. Like, if I pay attention to you and all every move you make, every sound you do, you make, then I can maybe keep myself safe. So vigilance is a survival mechanism that we use, right? Honestly, I think we are all sensitive people and we're born that way. And I think people who grow up in trauma have to keep it heightened in order to survive. Because there's a highly sensitive person. And I'm like, everybody is, but people with trauma have to turn up the volume for survival. Because I think we're all born, you look at babies, like I think we're all sensitive people, but some people don't need it on volume 100 in order to survive. But people who go through overwhelming experiences have to keep that vigilance on overdrive in order to survive. So I think there's so many, like most of the therapists I know are highly sensitive people, not because they're lovely people, they are, but because they needed to be highly sensitive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, those we're a bunch of caretakers because we needed to be, right? So I think there's that piece too. Another thing that I will say is that highly sensitive is about survival in the way that we have to focus on the other person and disconnect from ourselves in order to survive. So if I have to choose between what I'm feeling and what you're feeling, I, as a child, will choose what you're feeling because I need you to survive, right? So, and what I'm feeling is so overwhelming, it's too much for me. So we disconnect 100% of the time to focus on the other for survival purposes. Kids do this all the time.
Yeah.
So for me, I think we're all sensitive. We're all emotional beings. We're all naturally connected. But if you grow up in these kind of environments of developmental trauma or relational trauma, you overly develop certain coping strategies and you overly develop a sensitivity that is survival based, but it's also overwhelming. Suppress it. So I think it's complicated. You know, I don't think sensitive people are more likely to get abused than non-sensitive people, although some people do say that, right? If you're more vulnerable, if you were more sensitive, you know, and let me just stop there for a minute, because I think in some circumstances that is true. If you are a highly sensitive person and you have a parent who is needing to suppress their own stuff, they get activated by your sensitivity. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
So there is that piece too. There's parents that will squash. Don't be, you know, this is what happening. Don't play with dolls. What's wrong with you? You know, don't be so sensitive. Boys are supposed to be tough and strong, you know, and when you have parents that kind of squash kids' sensitivities, it's because the parent can't tolerate their own sensitivity or their own emotions. So when they see their children being overly emotional, they have to squash it in the kid because it's too activating for them, right? So I do think that dynamic also occurs. right? If you, because, you know, I am a sensitive kid. How much of that is because of my trauma and how much of that is because of my temperament? It's kind of hard to say. It's mm-hmm. hard to tease those out. But I think both end up happening.
So what helped you then? What kind of resources or insight helped you? I mean, you said that you went to therapy when you were in your studies 5 times a week. But what kind of specific resources or insights helped you to understand that? What was happening?
So great question. Like, and you hesitated there for a moment. Like, which therapy are we talking about, Frank? Because I've been a therapy lifer. I've been in therapy, you know, over and over. I'm still in therapy, you know, and I will be in therapy. But what you're asking, I think, and what I'll speak to is what I'm studying is resilience. It's like, what is that word? Like, what does resilience really mean? And what was it about me? I don't even know the answer to this, honestly. Like, I had some drive in me that said, you're not going to get the best of me. You will never win. I'm going to survive. I remember this as a kid when my dad would be like, attacking me or screaming at me or hitting me, chasing me throughout the house. It's like, you will not win. I will not be taken over. When I was in my residency program, there was a book that we were told to read called Soul Murder. And I remember, it's a great title, right? About trauma. Mm. I remember thinking, my soul wasn't murdered. Like I had a tenacity about mm-hmm. me that really, I didn't get taken over. My mm-hmm. soul didn't get murdered. So there was something in me, some quality that kept striving and driving myself to survive, to not get swallowed up by my trauma, you know? And I don't know exactly what that it factor is. Like, why did I not become a drug addict and homeless on the streets? And why did I become like a famous trauma specialist? Like, how the heck did that happen? Mm-hmm. You know, it could have gone either way, right? And I don't know that we know exactly what that quality is, you know, for each person. Sometimes people will say, did you have that one person in your life who saw you and cared about you? Maybe yeah. that was it. My grandfather always saw me and loved me. Maybe that's why I had this resilience. You know, I'm not quite sure, but from a very young age, I was driven to succeed and I was driven to be loved, which is why the title of my memoir is To Be Loved, right? It's the perfect title for my personal trauma story, because it started very early on, you know, and it's been a lifelong desire. So I look at people. I'm going to say one other thing about this, because I just recently came back from a trip to China and Cambodia. And, you know, to be immersed in these cultures that have so much trauma in them mm-hmm. is very powerful and overwhelming for me in a very life-changing way. You know, everywhere I travel, trauma and the resiliency of the human spirit is everywhere, right? And so when I was in Cambodia and meeting with a prisoner who survived the killing fields, right? Died, 2 of 18,000 people. He was one of 2 survivors out of 18,000 who was killed. Died in the genocide. Like, talk about overwhelming trauma. Mm-hmm. The quality that this guy had is something that I believe is part of resilience. Mm-hmm. And what he said was, when I was in the prisons, I knew I would do everything in my power to make sure nobody else would experience what I experienced. So he had this quality of stepping outside of himself to help others. Viktor Frankl talks about this also, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I just spoke to another podcast guest about man's search for meaning. So this was in my head as you were talking.
Exactly. Yes, and I have that. I have that, and I don't know if that's the it factor. I after my second book, Transcending Trauma, came out, I really got a message. It was a message that I went for a run. And this message showed up and it said, you have to bring trauma healing to the world. I thought, why the hell me? Me? Like, what? It's me. It's Frank, you know? And it was when my purpose got clarified. Mm-hmm. I've been helping people heal from trauma my whole life, really. Starting as a young kid with our, you know, my neighbor who was psychotic. So I had that natural inclination to help others. But it was at that moment that I got this message, you're here to bring trauma healing to the world. I said, that's my purpose. That is why I'm here. And it is about something larger than me. And it is about helping service to the world, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that's what Viktor Frankl talks about, you know, the way people survived in concentration camps and the way this person, the survivor of the Cambodian genocide. So I think there is something in our capacity, which is very paradoxical, because when you're traumatized, it's about self-survival, right? So you have to survive, but maybe survival and resilience is about the capacity to step outside of yourself and have a cause greater than you. That's what I think we're talking about here.
Mm.
So, you know, survival. Yeah, go ahead.
This terminology about resilience is very interesting. And so I want to clarify for those people listening what you believe about it. Because when I look back to my story of loss of my daughter and then subsequently my mother who died from suicide 4 months later. I remember the first few, let's say 18 months. I did not believe that I had any form of resilience. However, when I look back from it now, I see that the ember was there all along. I was clouded and quite understandably with that shock of new motherhood and then losing the twin sister of my daughter and then my mother. It was just overwhelming, as you describe it. So I wasn't able to see it if I had, but looking back, I can see where it was. So my question, and I'm really interested to hear what you have to say. Do you feel that resilience is something that someone just has or doesn't have? Or do we all have it and not everybody can see it or feel it or tap into it? Or is it a skill or a talent that can be learned and practiced?
I think it's both. So Angela Duckworth, who wrote this book called Grit, talks about the way we can teach resilience and the way that parents can always kind of support children, but also have them keep striving for better and striving for more. So Angela Duckworth will say, you can teach grit or resilience. So that's one philosophy and one belief system. Rick Hansen and Desmond Tutu talk about forgiveness and resilience, right? And they talk about what are the factors that can support resilience, right? So then there's the, can we teach it? What can we do to foster it? And I'm going to say, this is where I talk about environment versus temperament. I was born, and I think you're born with it. There's some it thing that I have that I don't see in everyone, you know, and I don't think I'm special. I don't even understand why I was born with that thing that constantly makes me strive to overcome and do better. So I do think it's multifaceted. I think it's not one answer. And I think it manifests itself differently for different people, right? Because I think some people we can support it. Like I can see my oldest son who had some kind of traumatic events when he was younger. I know my husband and I are supporting him now in the fostering his resilience. I could see it. He tolerates anger better. He can deal with disappointment better. Like, I'm really supporting him in his development to have more resilience. I know we're environmentally supporting that. I don't think he has that dramatic it factor in the way that I do. So I think you can teach it. And I think there are certain conditions that can foster it. You know, I wrote an article a while ago about resilience, and it's like, can people tolerate uncertainty? Can people form connect relationships? Can they step outside of themselves? Are they interested in learning and growing from experience, or do they repeat it or repress it? Right. So, how much can they tolerate difficult emotions? I think there are certain factors that I'm always assessing and looking at around who has the capacity for more or less resilience. But I don't think there are people that have none of it. I think it's a spectrum and a range.
Hmm. You know, I've been thinking about those people that unfortunately are not coming to see me, but there's voices that I see in the forums that I'm part of who sort of perpetuate the idea of grief is a life sentence or it's never going to get better. And I'm really sad for these people because this is not my experience and not the experience of the people that have the chance to get to work with me. So that's why I was asking that. Is it certain people's not ability to tap into it, or is it that through their psychological makeup that they're just not possibly able to go there and step outside of themselves?
I think it's both. If I think about some of my clients, some of my family members, some of the people that are in my life, I think, you know, I always say this thing, like, we have these, adverse moment, we can either repress it, we repeat it, or we learn and grow from it, right? So I think we always have opportunities with anything that shows up. And I think some people naturally repress, and that's their tendency. I think some people repeat, and then eventually learn and grow. Yeah. I think, you know, so I think there's always these choices, and I don't think we're stuck in one of those three forever. I think there's this, you know, what are the environmental factors? What are the life circumstances? What have you, you know, learned from your experience? So I think there's a range in there, you know, of you can, I certainly, I'll tell you this, I was a repeater for many years before I became a learn and grow from it person, right? I did a lot of repeating my trauma and a lot of my relationships for sure. So I think it's not a stagnant thing. I don't think it's, you know, but I also do know people who don't seem to have the capacity to rise above it at all, no matter what, no matter what services are thrown their way, no matter what supports they have in their life, they're missing something that doesn't enable them to really be able to rise above it. And so I do think that exists also. Very few people have I come across that are in that category, honestly, because I've seen a lot of people over the years with a lot of horrific trauma. And more common for me is the capacity for resilience and growth. But I have come across people that, for whatever reason, just don't seem to have it to be able to do it.
I have actually pinpointed some elements that lead to what you're describing, and I'd love your view on that. One of the things that I see is in my work, where I work with people dealing with a loss, is if there's a strong coupling between pain equals connection to my loved one, and if I let go of the pain, what's left? So that I see often. And another part in the puzzle is there is the secondary gain of remaining where they are with the pain, which is very individual what the secondary gains are. But there must be something that is so valuable that it's difficult to let go of. Yeah. Or a third one is often guilt. There's some form of guilt.
Yeah.
Tied into the loss or the trauma there, where it's like, I can't let go because I'm in some form, what they're saying to themselves is, I'm I'm guilty of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
What is your view on that?
Yeah, yeah. I do think I think when we connect pain, when pain is connected to connection, I think that's a very powerful motivator. It's like, you know, I know some people, kind of pretty famous people in the world who are out there speaking about trauma, and they experience fighting and pain as connection. And they get alive when there's a fight, right? So that this association or connection with pain and connection, it lights them up in a way that's really kind of paradoxical. And I know their trauma history enough to know that it's rooted in their history where pain and connection get linked. So I do think that's a thing. I think that can be healed, by the way. Mm-hmm. I think you don't have to have that as a life sentence. I also really feel the guilt piece that you talk about really important, because it's so common in my work for people that either have attachment trauma or around feeling guilty and responsible for the loss in some way, as if it gives them some sense of control. It happens over and over and over again. So I often see guilt connected to control because of the inability to tolerate the loss. Mm-hmm. So I think that a lot. The other thing around guilt, and this is something that I've really grown and learned about personally through my own journey of my own healing, and is really the hallmark of the book of To Be Loved, is forgiveness. It's this piece around our capacity to forgive someone who has harmed us enables us to then forgive ourselves for what we have done. So for me, there's this strong connection. And I'm not saying forgiveness is a requirement for healing. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying in my experience, the guilt piece is like, if I can forgive somebody else for the horrific things that they have done to me, it opens up space within myself to be able to forgive me for the things that I have done. And I think that's a very complicated dynamic that I'm really exploring and teaching more and more about, because we all have been victimized in some ways, and we all have done harmful things. Mm-hmm. And nobody, in my experience, is only one or the other. And that's a very complicated dynamic when we've been hurt or we've hurt. So that's what I look at when I'm kind of exploring these dimensions of healing grief and loss.
Mm. Well, Frank, I haven't even touched the surface speaking to you. It's so interesting. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, maybe this is for a second episode, you know, how internal family systems works in connection to that. But given the time that we have and sort of my listeners are used to the sort of format, if we were to round this up, would it be okay? Is there something else that you want to say beside the fact that all the links that you've mentioned and all the good points that you have are going to be in the show notes? But is there any other last thing that you would want to impart our listeners with?
No, I love this conversation. I think we've tapped on a lot of things that expand the depth and go a little deeper from the superficial kind of grief and trauma things. Mm-hmm. So I'm really happy with what we were able to discuss and get into today. So I don't have anything residual that I'm holding that I need to share at this point.
So as you know, I end with all my guests with the rapid fire question. Shall we do that now?
Sure.
So grieving and trauma means?
Getting in touch with your humanity and the humanity of everyone else around us.
And healing means?
Healing means having the capacity to release what no longer serves you or doesn't belong to you.
And what have you learned about yourself in the light of loss and trauma?
I have learned that I am a person who feels deeply. And that is because I have been through some horrific experiences that have enabled me to hold life's complexities in a way that I never thought was possible.
And what would be one thing you wish people knew about loss and trauma?
That we all can heal from what we've experienced.
Yes,
that healing
absolutely.
Is possible.
And one specific thing that has changed since your losses and traumas that you wouldn't want to miss, what would that be?
Yeah, I am very clear about the fact that I am grateful for my trauma now in a way that I would have never thought before, because I would not be here today. I wouldn't be a trauma expert. I wouldn't be affecting so many lives throughout the world had it not be for my trauma history. So I really have love and admiration for the people that have harmed me truly, because it was because of them that I'm here today having such an impact on so many people throughout the world. So that is a surprise to me, but it is truly how I feel now.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, my heart is extremely full and I have a secret hope that this won't be the last conversation.
Lovely, lovely. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for doing this work, because I do think it takes a village and we are all part of this interconnected web of healing. So thank you for doing what you do and having me here.
Thanks for listening to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. If you'd like to be updated on future episodes, please subscribe to my newsletter on nataliehimmelrich.com. If you need grief support, please contact me for a 30 minutes free discovery session. How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. To support this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And remember to keep reading. I promise it will get easier.